And we know that from studying last week that Moses has fled Egypt. And he's now in Midian. And he has found himself living in among the people of Midian, distant relatives of the Jews. And he has married and has a couple children, a couple sons. And he now takes care of the sheep of his father-in-law. And he's been doing this for 40 years. So now he's 80 years old. And you know, that's kind of like the retirement time, you know what I mean? It's 80, time to settle down and just go, okay, I'm relaxing, I've worked long enough. Life is on the downside here, I've got this little bit of time left. But this is the time where God says, okay, time to go to work. Right in the middle of that. He's been there for 40 years, out in the wilderness there and taking care of sheep. And that was, you know, I think he's gotten used to it. That's my life. This is where I am. This is what I'm doing. You know, all the things I thought my life would be like in the past, all the things that happened to me, well, at least I'm here and I'm safe and I have a family and, you know, here we are. And we have no mention of God. No mention of God at all in the first three chapters, up to the third chapter here. There's no God around. The people are suffering. We found at the end of chapter 2, they're crying out to God now, asking God to help them, to deliver them. They are they're in slavery. They've been in bondage. And it's just gotten worse over time. And they've been there for how many years? Well, close to 400, being slaves. And it's a dead end. And there's nothing they feel they can do. There's no help. And so they call upon a God they really don't know. And so we see here in the third chapter, God will reveal himself. He will show himself to Moses, and an unfolding revelation of who God is. The God, I'm your God. I'm the God of Abraham, Jacob, and Isaac and Jacob. And he will then reveal himself to them like he has not in any time in history, in ways that has not happened before. And we have this amazing encounter with God here. So let's read, and then we'll make some observations and comments here. Okay, it says, now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And there the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flames of fire from within a bush. And Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. Do I got an echo on this thing? Didn't want to be that dramatic, but anyhow. So he says, so Moses thought, I will go over to and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. And when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. And then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. And the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt, and I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. And I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and bring them out, up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, the Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, and all kinds of other sites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way of the Egyptians and how they are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I'll be with you. And this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. And Moses said to God, Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, Who is his name? Or what is his name? And then what shall I tell them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, Say to the Israelites, The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation. So we have an encounter here with God. Moses is there in the desert. Do we have a map? Did I put a map in there anywhere? I thought I had a map in there somewhere. Do I? There we go. So you see over here the word Midian on the side there, okay? And then you have the Gulf, the Suez Gulf, and if you go up farther, you see Israel on the right and Egypt on the left. And if you keep on going further up, you'll see it'll be the Mediterranean Sea up there, which we don't see on the map, okay? So that's kind of the lay of the thing. And he left Ramses there on the left-hand upper corner of the map there and came down through the wilderness onto past Ezion Geber, and came along down into Midian. That's where he was in Midian. That's where his father-in-law was. That's where he settled. But at this time, he went around there and came over into the Sinai. And down at the bottom there, in the area of, we believe that to be the area of Mount Sinai and the Horeb area, is where he went to graze his sheep. There's quite a distance. Apparently, I would think that there had been enough grazing of the sheep and stuff in these areas over here, and he decided to go over here a little bit better. Vegetation, more for the sheep that he was going to be taking care of. And as he's there, that's where he has this encounter with God. Now, here's the thing. We don't have God mentioned up to this point. There is no God. And can you imagine what life would be like without God? What would life be if there was no God? Because there are people, you know, who have that perspective that there is no God, that God doesn't exist. In fact, all that there is what you see. What you see and what you can touch and what you can feel, what you can taste with your physical senses, the physical universe is all there is. The material universe is all there is. This whole thing about a spiritual world where there's a God that doesn't exist. It isn't real. One of those things we can verify through science, and the methods of science, is real. The other is not real. So what would life be like if there were no God? If it was true that there is no God? Well, here's some points I wanted to make. What life would be like. Life would be meaningless. Life would be meaningless. There would be no purpose for you being alive. See, the thing is, you don't know what your purpose is unless you know what you were made for. If you don't know what you were made for, you can't know what your purpose is. This phone, if I don't know what it was made for, I don't know what its purpose is. And I'm looking at this thing, well, this is something I can use to, you know, put that nail in the board, the 2x4. Well, no, you really can't, because it wasn't made for that. See, that's not the purpose of this device or this black thing that I have in my hand. It wasn't made for pounding nails in. It was made for something else. So if you don't know what it was made for, you don't know what its purpose is. So if there is no God, you don't know what your purpose is. You don't know what you were made for. You don't know why you're here, because you are an accident. You have no purpose. It's a random thing that happened through various physical properties and different things. They all came together, and you are who you are, and it's just what it is. And here's the thing, too. If there is no spiritual or non-material part of the universe, it doesn't exist, and only the material exists, then you're just like any other thing that's material. You're no better than a rock. You have no purpose and no meaning to your life. You're just a rock that's here, and then eventually, as the processes of nature work, and you turn into dust, and pretty soon you're not there. Over the centuries, you have no more value than a rock does, and so your life has no purpose, no meaning, and you have no value because there is no God. Okay, number two. Good and evil wouldn't exist. Good and evil wouldn't exist. What do you mean by that? There are a lot of things that are evil. Well, that's your opinion. See, because if there is no God, how do you know what is good and what is evil? What is right and what is wrong? What do you mean by that? I know what's right. No, you don't. See, the thing is, if there is no God, then basically what you have is just physical world. And when you talk about the physical world, I don't know of any physical moral law. There is no physical moral law. That's a non-physical thing. That's an immaterial thing. Did you get what I'm saying? It's not a material thing. It's other than material. So it doesn't fall within the material world. It is basically a part of the physical. It's just a matter of opinion. It's a construct that you as a group of people say, this is what we decide. We like this, so this is what is good. We don't like that, so that's not good. We think this is right, because we all agree to that. The majority of us do. And there's a few people who think it's not right, and they think it's bad. Well, too bad for them, because we decided that this is good. And that's how it works. It's a matter of whoever group has the power to decide, they're the ones that determine what is good and what is evil or bad, because it's an immaterial thing, and it's not, it's a matter of personal opinion and choice. There's a doctor of philosophy named Richard Rorty, and he admitted that for secular liberals such as himself, there is no answer to the question, why not be cruel? There's no reason why not be cruel? Well, because I think that's bad. Well, why do you think it's bad? Because people get hurt. So why isn't that just part of the natural order of things? Doesn't the strongest determine what is the thing that should be done? Don't the strong rule the weak? Doesn't the strong eat up and destroy the weak? Doesn't the surviving of the fittest, isn't that the way of the material world? So if that's the case, then who says what is cruel? Because there are some people who think eliminating one whole race of people is not cruel. They think that's a good thing to do. In fact, that's one of their goals, is to eliminate that race of people from the face of the earth, and that nation is to be wiped clean because those people are evil. Well, who decided that? They did. That's what they think is good. Well, how can you say that's good? Because that's what they believe. And that's what they choose. See, if there's not a God who's outside of that and says, this is what's right, and this is what's good, and this is what's evil, and this is what's wrong for all time and all people and all times, then who determines it? Well, it's whoever has the greatest power to do it. Because it's a matter of who surviving of the fittest. That's how nature works. That's how the natural world works. Here's another thing. If there is no God, the non-material world doesn't exist. So if there is no non-material world, I'm meaning the physical, there's nothing that isn't physical, then spirit, heaven, God, those things don't exist because they're not physical. Example, if God doesn't exist, then everything that is not material or physical doesn't exist. So if God doesn't exist, love doesn't exist. There's no, you can't go over and buy a bottle of love. You can't put it and rub it on your skin. I mean, it's not something that is a physical thing. It's a non-material thing. And so if there is no God, then there is no non-material world. Therefore, love doesn't exist. All that love is the interaction of neurons and chemical processes that are in your brain that cause you to react and act a certain way. It has nothing to do with anything in the immaterial world. It has everything to do with the material world and the processes of the material world. That's how you explain it. Isn't this a wonderful world that we live in? Here's another thing. If there is no God, there would be no afterlife. There would be no afterlife. Because once you die in the material world, that's it. There is nothing after. Okay. So if there's nothing after, if only the physical life exists so that when your physical life ends, everything ends for you, well then, then you don't have any hope for the future. Once your life comes to that place where you're facing death, that's it. And there's no future. You have no hope for the future because your future has an end. Another thing, too. Have you noticed that some people get away with things? And they don't get punished. They don't get consequences. It seems as though they get away with everything. And they abuse people, they have murdered people, they've done all kinds of horrible things, and there is no justice for you because they they're never caught, they never repent, they never say they're sorry, they will go off and eventually die of old age, and that's it. There's no justice. If there's no God, there is no justice. Because we know that God, and after this world has passed away, and heaven, and He comes down to rule this world, He will right all wrongs. He will punish those that deserve punishment. He will make sure that there is justice in the world. So if God does not really exist, there's no guarantee of anything. In fact, justice is, again, another personal opinion of what they deserve and what they don't deserve. So, now if God does really exist, how can you know for sure? Or, let me put it this way. How can you have an encounter with the real God? Well, I think we can gain some insight through this experience of Moses, as we see looking at the history here of what happened to Moses. We find a little bit of insight about how people have encounters. Not everyone has an encounter with God this way, but many of us do. This is the way God reveals Himself to us. And we can gain some insight on how that happens through this story. So, first of all, let's look at this. First point I want to make. How do you encounter God? It's usually in the detours of life. It's usually in the detours of life that you gain this encounter. Now, what is a detour? You're going along a certain direction, a certain path, a certain road, and something interrupts you and forces you to go another way, a detour. Okay? Now, Moses, his whole life has been a detour. I mean, he was born, and his life's direction was going in a specific direction, where he is adopted into the palace as one of the Pharaoh's children. He's adopted into the family. He is educated. He's very well-to-do. He's privileged. He's part of the elite. His life and his trajectory of his life, where is it going? It's going a whole direction here. And does it continue to go that way? No, it's been interrupted. And where does he find himself? In a desert, in a wilderness. Is that where he thought he would be going with his life? No, he had thought he would be used of God to stop this injustice, to right these wrongs, to free these people from the oppression and the suffering that they're in. He'd be the one to do that. And was he? Well, not yet. He finds himself running for his life, and he's taking care of sheep out in the wilderness. I talk about a detour. That was a major detour. Now, here's a small detour. As he's walking out there with the sheep, and we don't see anybody else with him in this story, so he's by himself out there. And what does he see? He sees this burning bush. Well, you don't see a burning bush out there every day. It's not like you've never seen a burning bush, but this one he sees. And as he looks at it, he notices that it's still burning. And he's been watching it for a while now, and it's still burning, and nothing's changing. It's just burning. And what does he do? He goes, you know, I think, verse 3 says, so Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. I will go over. So there's kind of, you can imagine, there's maybe some kind of little bed of a stream that when it does rain there, it has a, you know, we go down to Mexico sometimes and you see these huge open spaces where you know that there's been water there before, but it's nothing there. There's a little trickle. And so you can imagine he's standing on one side and there's a bush and he says, I'm going to go over and see what's that. So he leaves the sheep and goes down and comes up to where the bush is. And so here's the thing. What is the detour in our life? Well, it's usually when our life goes in a direction we never planned for it. You had planned and you're going to go this direction. You have done all the things you think you need to do to be going this place and to get to that place, and you find yourself instead detoured, and now you're taking care of sheep. And you find that your life and what you planned is not going according to plan. It's been interrupted. So instead of being a deliverer, you're an alien and a fugitive in a land that was not your choice. And so this detour of taking care of sheep enables him to be a place, in the right place he needs to be able to see the bush, see this burning bush. Now here's a point I want to make, is that God meets us when we're in that wilderness many times. That's where we have these encounters with God, is in these places that we never intended, in places that we don't really want to be, in places that we think, shouldn't be happening to me. This is the wrong thing for me. I don't know how this happened, but I don't deserve this. Or this is not right. Or this doesn't make any sense. Why would this be happening to me? And it's in those times where your plans are not working, when your plans are not happening, those are the times where God says, okay, I've got his attention. Now let's get a little burning bush and get his attention more. Okay, so now, God, the point I want to make here now is God will call you from a burning bush. Now, what is a burning bush? Well, isn't normal. It doesn't fit your normal explanation of things. It doesn't really fit the way you see things as normal. It's something you can't explain. It challenges how you understand how things are supposed to be, what reality is. It doesn't make sense to you. And you go, wow, what is this? And when you encounter that burning bush, it challenges how you think and changes you and makes you see things in a different way. Someone puts it as a paradigm shift. In other words, you have a whole other way of looking at things now because of this encounter with this burning bush. So Moses, as he's out there taking care of the sheep, you know, and they're wandering around out there, he could have just said, you know, I see it. What is that? That's weird. Anyhow, I got a lot of things to do. You know, a couple sheep have gone missing. I got to find those things. There's another one that looks like its leg is injured. I have to take care of that thing and carry it over to here. And, you know, I don't know how much food I have. I make sure I got to get, you know, he could say, I'm busy. I got things to do. I got things I need to take care of. I don't have time for this. I don't even know what that means. And I'm not even going to think about it. He could have done that. But instead, he decides that, you know what? I need to go see what this is about. I need to think about this. I need to look at this and see what this really is. And so we find that there are times in our life where you have those burning bushes where the things are not happening the way you think they should. And what should be the way things work isn't working. And it starts to challenge your whole assumption of how your life should be and what should be in your life. Okay? Let me just give you a little example. Let's say success has been very important to you. You've looked at your life and said, you know, if I can become successful in blank, if my life can be a success, I know that once I get all those things together and it becomes a success, my life will finally come together. I'll finally be satisfied and not restless anymore. I'll be okay. My life will be good. So you strive down that path and you find yourself successful, and then the burning bush catches your attention because you say, I'm not happy. I'm successful, but I'm empty. I don't feel satisfied. What is this about? This is just doesn't make sense. My whole life has been geared to this. I've been striving. This has been my motivation and my drive for my life. And now I'm successful and it's not here. What's missing? There's something missing. I don't even know what it is. What is this? What is that? That's God calling to you. He says, you can't have a meaningful and full life without me. Just being successful is not enough for you because you are a spiritual being and you need me in your life. Now, does that make any sense? So God is trying to get your attention. And the way he gets your attention is in those kind of circumstances. And we all know and have experienced many of those kind of situations where things don't seem to go as they're supposed to, where we find things are inexplicable. Why is this happening? Why is this going this way? This doesn't make any sense. And as you look at those things, you can say, well, I just need to be more successful. I need greater success. That's what I need. Or you can say, I'm not going to think about it. Maybe what I need is, I need a big family. Or I need, you know, you can start to go on other pursuits and do other things and ignore that call that's there saying, your life, I'm trying to get your attention. Come here. So, when Moses comes and sees this burning bush and he goes over to it, then what happens? Hello, Moses.
What?
He's not expecting this. Now, the way God addresses him was Moses, Moses. Which is kind of an endearing way of and a way of speaking to someone in that culture where it would be in a welcoming kind of a way. You know, we might do that too. So, Roger, Roger. You know, it's kind of like you're going, okay, I wasn't paying attention. What did you say? You know, and so you see that. So he is going to meet the real God. Now, here's the thing. You can't make up your own God and expect to meet the real God. Okay? You can't make up your own God and expect to meet the real God. Now, God is going to reveal himself to him because Moses will ask him, so who should I call? Tell everybody that you, what's your name? Who should I say you are? Remember? So the conversation has gone like this. He says, Moses, Moses. Yeah, yeah. What? Oh, yeah, take off your shoes. You're on holy ground. What? Ooh, ah. You know, and he's kind of getting freaked out here because he's starting to realize this is not, you know, something normal. This is something supernatural. This is something this is God. Because he addresses him saying, I am the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, as they have the conversation, God tells them that I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, and I want you to go down to Egypt and I want you to do this. He says, oh, wow, that's too big. I don't know. I don't think I have what it takes to do that. And I want you, now Moses, I want you to go and do this. Who should I say that you are? Here's the thing. He's starting to put up a little resistance to this God who has a purpose for him. Because see, this is another thing about this. When God, you encounter God, he doesn't just reveal himself to you. He also gives you something to do. It's always something to do. Whenever you have had an experience with God and you've had an encounter with God, he has something for you to do. That's part of the what happens when you have these encounters. Now, he says, who are you? And this is what he responds. I am who I am. He doesn't say I'm this or that. He just says, I am who I am. What does that mean? I am who I am. In other words, he says, I am the God who exists. I exist. And a lot of times we go, well, I don't like that God that exists. I mean, that's what kind of Moses is doing. I don't really like this plan that you have. I like the part where you said, I'm coming down and I'm going to deliver my people, Israel, out of the slavery they're in. He's going, yeah. Yeah. Now, go down to Egypt and deliver the people for me. What? Who changed the plan here? I'm not necessarily up for this. You know, he's resisting this God who exists. And here's the thing. A lot of times we don't like the God who exists. We don't like the God who is real. We want to make up our own God. We want to create our own God. I don't like the God that you have. It's okay for you, but my God is different than your God. My God, he's a loving God. He's a kind God. He's approving. He approves of me. He supports me in my decisions that I make and the things that I want to do and who I want to be. He's all for it. So, and he's not restrictive and he's not condemning or any of those things. He gives me freedom to be who I am. And, you know, that's the God I believe in. Well, good for you. The fact is, that's something you've made up. You've put together. See, what Moses is dealing with is that he can't shape God into what he wants him to be. He has to accept him as he is. He is who he is. And you have to take him as who he is. And you can't change God. And so, say, for instance, suppose someone comes up to you and says, you know, I want to have a relationship with you. And if you don't mind, I'd just like to say, when I think of you, I think of somebody who's hard-headed, who's uncompromising, it doesn't bend or change, and it always has to be right, and never is wrong, and you're really kind of an annoying person. That's how I see you. And you're going, I don't think you want a relationship with me. Then why I don't think you want a relationship with me? Because you don't want to know who I am. You have a already set idea of who I am, and then you're going to put that on me. That doesn't mean you want to have a relationship with me. You want to make me into something. And I am not going to do that. That's not how you have a relationship with somebody. See, the thing about a real relationship, because God is a person. God is real. He has personality. He has he's a person. He's not an it. And because he's a person, he's like other persons. When you have a relationship with a person, do you know of anybody that you have a relationship that is 100% whatever you say, that's great for them? You go, you know, I want to do this, and they go, that's the best idea I've ever heard. Wonderful. I'm going to change my mind, though. I'm not going to do that. Well, that's great, too. Yeah. No, you don't have anybody like that in your life. They go, that's stupid. That's a boneheaded thing to do. You know, I don't agree with you. I don't think that's right. I don't like you. I don't want to have a relationship with you. Well, the fact is, if you want to have a relationship with somebody, you're going to have those kind of confrontations. You're going to have those disagreements. You're going to have those kind of conflicts. You're going to have those things because that's what persons are like. And God is a person. And so if you try to come up to him and say, I want a relationship with you, but you can't be this and you can't be that, and you can't do this, and I can't have you doing this. No, you don't want a relationship. You want to make him into something. And so if you're going to have an encounter with the real God who will show up when you need him, it needs to be real. And this is not a real God if you make him up and put them together with all the qualities that you want and leave all the others out. You can't pick and choose with God. You know, I like this part of the Bible, but where God does this, I don't like that part. I'm not going to scratch that part. Well, then you're not going to meet the real God. So, the metaphor here, when we look at the encounter that Moses has, is that he encounters this fire, a flame of fire. Now, what is this metaphor? What are some of the implications here of that? That God is fire. We were singing this morning, come all-consuming fire, fall on us. And a lot of places you'll see in the Scripture where God is likened to a fire, you know. Our God is a consuming fire. So what is this thing about fire? Well, with water, you can put your hand in water and swish it around and stir it and guide it maybe even or splash it. And your hand can influence that water. It can do things with that water. Now try that with fire. It doesn't work that way. You can't just go in there and just say, no. You do that and it burns you. It'll consume you. You don't influence it. It influences you. See what I'm saying? And that's one of the points of this picture, is that God is not something you can tamper with and change and manipulate. No, it has the effect on you. He's the one that consumes you. He's the one that has influence on you. So God doesn't change. You change. God doesn't follow your directions. You follow his directions. Make sense? So, let's take a look quickly about who is this God. So, when Moses comes, one of the things we find about that God has revealed himself as is that he is a holy God. He is a holy God. That's who God is. He's a holy God. Now, what does he say? He says you need to take off your shoes, for you're on holy ground. Was there certain places in Sinai where there was holy ground and other places where there wasn't holy ground? So if you kind of walk around, you go, oh, don't walk over there, that's holy ground. Okay, if you go past around here, then you pass the holy, well, over there's another holy ground. No, go over there. No. What made it holy was that God was there. Okay? So that's the whole point of the holy ground, is that you're coming into the presence of a holy God. Now, what is his response? As he comes and he's walking in the holy ground, what does God say? He says, okay, Moses, come over here. I want to give you a big hug. No, he doesn't do that. He says, stop. Don't come close. Because this is holy ground. When you have God appearing to the Jews later on in the book of Exodus, he comes down upon the Mount of God, Mount Sinai, and he warns the people. Moses warned them that there's a line here at the bottom of the hill, and no one should pass that line or they will die. And when he realizes that it is in holy ground, it's like a danger zone. This is danger zone. You need to be aware that this is not safe here in the holy presence of God. In fact, what does he do? He covers his face. Remember earlier, Jacob says, and I met God and I didn't die. This was a common understanding, still is a common understanding, of if you are in the presence of God, you as a mortal, he's holy and you're not, and God is consuming fire. In other words, he is against evil, he is against sin, he can't tolerate those things, and he will destroy them. He's going to get rid of all those things that are evil and sin in all its forms. And so guess what? You are sinful, so you have something to fear. Because God is holy. That's something we know about God. God is holy. But another thing about God is that he's a caring God. Notice that he talks about, I've noticed this. I've been intently looking at these. I've paid close attention to what was happening with this. And he's expressing his interest, and you know, that's one way you can show people you care about them, is you show interest. How do you know if someone doesn't really care about you? They ignore you. God doesn't ignore this situation. Yes, he has his own timing of how things work and when he intervenes, but he speaks of his care for the people of Israel, and that he has been watching this. He's been intently looking at this things. He feels what they feel. He sees what they are dealing with and the suffering that they have. And so we see that God, this God who is holy, is also a caring God. And also we see that he's a God of action. He's come down, he says, not just to watch some more, to get a closer view, which is not possible for him. He's always close as he's everywhere. But he's going to do something now. He's going to take action. Now, God has his own timing for those things, you know, when he does take action. But he is going to take action. And he's going to intervene. And he's going to deliver the people of Israel. So, God is a God of action. He hasn't said, okay, let's see, I'm kind of bored. I think I'll create a universe. Let's put these little things called people on this planet. Okay, looking good. Everything's working great. Okay, well, I'll move on. And just leave it. And have no more to do with it. No. He is intimately involved in his creation. He is not his creation, but he's involved in your life and my life and all that he's created. So that's one other thing we learn about God. Now, another thing we find, too, is that he's a patient God. A patient God. How do you know he's patient? Because here Moses is standing before God, and what is he doing? We'll find here in the next part of this chapter and part of chapter 4 that he's complaining and whining. God says, now I want you to do this. And he goes, I don't know. I can't. Yeah, I'm not good at talking. And yeah, you know this and that. He says, "Well, I'll be with you." Well, but you know, man. Yeah, okay, all right. Well, I'll give you what to say, and I'll be with you. Well, but I don't want to. Okay, take your brother with you, and have him talk for you. He's patient. He puts. I mean, can you imagine the God of the universe is holy? He's and being this holy God, and you. What are you doing? You're standing there whining. I mean, you're in danger. He could just go, oh, I had enough. That's it. Done with this. Let's get another one. How about a rock? I'll take a rock and do this. He's patient. Now, here's another thing about this God. In this chapter, we also see that at the beginning here, we find that there's an angel there. Now, who is this angel of the Lord? Who is this angel of the Lord? We find this angel of the Lord in several different places in the Scripture. We found it earlier in the book of Genesis. I might write this down. Genesis 31, if I haven't written it already. 31 and verses 11 through 13. It says, the angel of God, and this is speaking to Jacob. The angel of God said to me, in the dream, Jacob, I answered, here I am. And he said, look up and see that all the male goats mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, and spotted, for I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. Does this sound familiar? It sounds like the same kind of way of speaking. I've seen what has been happening to you. And I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now leave this land at once and go back to your native land. I don't know where the echo's coming from, but I think I got it. So, what is this situation here with the Jacob? Later on he says, I had this encounter with God, and I was, I called the place Bethel, house of God. And it was an angel. The angel of God met me. And when you see the angel of God, and then verse 13 says, I am the God. So what is happening here? We find that there's the angel of God, and he speaks as God. He speaks the words of God. He does things that only God can do. And so we see that this is a manifestation of God himself. So it is, next point, the Lord himself. This angel of the Lord is the Lord himself. Now, a way to translate this phrase, or best, a better way of translating this is the angel that is Yahweh, or the angel Yahweh, or angel Yahweh, period. The angel Yahweh, or angel Yahweh, or the angel that is Yahweh. So God is. So here's the thing about God. God is omnipresent. He's everywhere. There's no place that he's not. And so for him to localize and be in one spot where you could interact with him, there has to be a representation of him in that situation. Because you can't fully represent God for who he is, because we're not able to interact with infinity. You get what I'm saying? He's too big. He's too much of him to really be able to, being that we're finite and limited. There's a representation. There's a of God in this situation, and so he is. This angel is representing God. He is God, takes the persona of an angel. He is not an angel, but he takes the persona of an angel. We find this too, where God comes and he is manifested as a fire. When the people of Israel are leaving and they're in the desert, and God is directing them and guiding them, the angel Lord appears as a flame of fire during the evening, and then he's a pillar of smoke during the day. So there's these manifestations or these representations of God that express who God is in a way that we can understand Him. Okay? Now, this angel does all the things that God does, or all the things that God would do. He receives worship. He forgives sin. He commands. He demands obedience, etc., etc. Now, for God to be able to communicate with us, He needs a representation for us. He needs someone who can mediate for us, because we can't fully understand Him. So He has someone who will be a mediator between us and Him. Now, here's the thing. Because God is holy, He has an angel, the angel of the Lord, which I believe to be, in the Old Testament, a manifestation or representation of Jesus, okay, as the angel of the Lord. And He is the one that is communicating the will of God to Moses, and that's one of the reasons why Moses isn't burnt up. Because God has a mediator, someone who goes between Him, so to speak, and the full omnipresent all Trinity. He has Jesus. And we find this also in the New Testament. Jesus is our mediator. He goes for us. This in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 5, it says, "For there is one God and one mediator between God and man, or men, and it's the man Christ Jesus." Jesus came in the flesh, God in the flesh. He's fully God, but we don't see the fact that His omnipresence and all these things that He is. We only see Him in the form of a man, so that we can kind of comprehend and have a little bit of comprehension of who He is. But He's all God, but He comes and presents Himself that way so that we can handle it. Now, here's an interesting thing. In the book of John, in chapter 8, write this down, 56 and verse 56 through 59, Jesus has been having discussions with the Pharisees, the religious leaders, and of course they have a problem with Him. He's kind of messed things up in the temple. He's got saying things that they're not really happy with, etc. And they're not wanting to recognize His authority or that He has anything to say to them. They have authority. They are children of Abraham, but no less, children of God. We are God's people. And you know, who are you? Well, Jesus says, well, if you were of your father Abraham, you'd love me, but you don't love me. You hate me. So verse 56 continues this statement. He makes some things that are really, really shocking. He says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad." "You're not yet 50 years old," the Jews said to him. Do I still got that echo? Where's that echo coming from? Anyhow, sorry. Yeah, whoa! I am. Okay, right. So it says, "You're not yet 50 years old," the Jews said to him, "and you have seen Abraham?" "I tell you the truth," Jesus answered, "before Abraham was born, I am." "Am what?" "I am." Well, what? Where's that tied to? Well, right here. I am. Who I am. He is the God. He is the angel. He is the mediator. So at this, they picked up stones because they recognized what He was saying. But Jesus hid Himself, slipping away from the temple grounds because they are about to kill Him for blasphemy. Okay. So Jesus is the I am. He is the mediator between us and God. He's the one that makes it so that the holiness of God doesn't destroy us. He makes it possible for us to be in the presence of God. What does it talk about? I think it's Hebrews chapter 4. We can come into the presence of God boldly. Why? Because of Jesus. We can come now into the presence of God. We try to come in by ourselves. Not good. Not good. So this makes it possible for us to have a relationship with God because of the mediator. This angel of the Lord is speaking for God through the bush at this time to Moses. Moses has this encounter, recognizes that, you know, he's fascinated by the bush. It has an amazing quality to it, this burning fire. You know, a lot of times people like to look at fires and see a fire is beautiful. I don't know why we have fireplaces. We don't need them anymore, but people do. Why? Because they like to look at fire. In fact, I've even seen TVs with programs on it that just the fire. So it's not hot, it's fire just, you know, just, and they're sitting there with their tea and a book and watching the flames. It has a fascination, it's beautiful, but the real fire is dangerous too. So here's the thing about God. God is beautiful, he's loving, he's kind, he's wonderful, but he's also dangerous. Holy. Both of these things together come together. God is righteous, just, but also loving, kind, and forgiving. And where do we see this best illustrated? On the cross. Jesus, the holy Jesus, who takes upon himself the sin of the world and is judged for our sins. You see the justice of God, his hatred of sin and dealing with it and judging it, and you also see his love and mercy and kindness. Both of those two things together come together in Christ. And that makes it possible for us to have a relationship and come into God's presence because of who he is. So, that's a good segue to our communion, isn't it? So let's have the ushers come forward and we receive the communion this morning. As they make those preparations, we're going to